Oh, yes, that's right. So it is.
In that case, I have a feeling this online roundtable will have to go ahead without a Mario.
Mario says from the bed.
I don't know about you guys, but I am planning to score a lot of bitches at this hop. Probably I will start with one really hot girl, straight sex, no frills. Then I will have a 69. Then it will be time for a threesome.
Mario.
Dennis sits up.
What makes you think any girl is going to go anywhere near you, let alone, like, 15 different girls?
Mario hesitates, then says conspiratorially,
I have a secret weapon.
You do?
You bet, mister.
He flips open his wallet.
Read it and weep, boys. It is my lucky condom, which never fails.
A silence, as Mario smugly returns his wallet to his pocket. And then, clearing his throat, Dennis says,
Mario, in what way exactly is there anything lucky about that condom?
Never fails.
Mario repeats, a little defensively.
But...
Dennis pinches his fingers to his nose, brow furrowed.
I mean, if it was really a lucky condom, wouldn't you have used it by now?
How long have you had it in there, Mario?
Jeff says.
3 years.
3 years?
Without using it?
Doesn't that sound more like an unlucky condom?
Mario looks troubled as his unshakable faith in the luckiness of the lucky condom begins to show cracks.
It was definitely pretty unlucky for the condom to wind up in your wallet.
Yeah, Mario, your wallet is like the Alcatraz of condoms.
It's like the condom Bermuda Triangle.
Condoms tell each other stories about your wallet. Oh, he disappeared into Mario Bianchi's wallet, and he was never seen again.
Yeah. I bet right this very second your lucky condom is in there whistling the theme from The Great Escape and digging a tunnel out of your wallet with a plastic coffee stirrer.
What you know about it?
Mario rounds on them.
Eh, you silly nerds. All you know about is this foolish business of the theory of many dimensions. Well, I tell you about something that is happening in this dimension, and that is this Friday I will be boning countless ladies. And that, which I call Mario theory, is something that you can see with your own eyes, and not just some equations that only gays can understand. So don't come crawling to me looking for one of my many bitches in the sex orgy I am having after you have struck out with every girl at the hop.
Autumn deepens. A fresh chaos of yellow leaves covers the lane up to the school each morning, as if it's been visited overnight by woodland poltergeists. After school, you make the return journey through a strange, season-specific gloaming, a pale darkness, spooked and paradoxical, which makes your classmates up ahead seem to fade in and out of existence. The hobgoblin shadow of Halloween, meanwhile, is everywhere. The shopping malls bristle with pumpkins and skeletons. Houses lie swathed in cotton wool cobwebs. The sky cracks and fizzes with firework tests of increasing rigor. Even teachers fall under the spell. Classes take odd detours. Routines slowly vaporize. Until by the late stages of the week, the rigid precepts of everyday term time seem no more real, or even slightly less real, than the fluorescent ghosts glowing from the windows of Ed's Donuts next door. It's crossed Skippy's mind, though he knows it makes no sense, given that other people have seen her too, that Frisbee Girl herself might not be real, that she too may be a kind of Halloween emanation, a dark mirage of smoke and wishes, who exists only in the far end of the telescope, and will, if he tries to get any closer to her, vanish entirely. And so, while half of him is dying for it to be Friday, can scarcely comprehend how he can possibly make it till Friday, the other half hopes that Friday will never come. Time, however, has no such reservations, and now he wakes up in the pitch darkness of the last morning of term. For the last quarter of the swimming team's final training session, Coach reels in the laneway markers and brings out the net so they can play water polo. With a whap, the ball sails into the air. White and gold and brown bodies leap and splash. Yells and hoots clang and rebound from the yellow roof. Steam wafts across the water, like poison gas over a gaudy blue battlefield. Skippy's floating near the back, where there's not much happening.
"Come over here a minute, Daniel,"
Coach says. He crouches down as Skippy swims up to him. It hurts him to bend like this. You can see it in the way his eyes screw up.
"You've missed a lot of training lately."
"Sorry, Coach. I was sick. I have a note."
"Notes are all well and good, but you'll need to make that work up somehow. The meet's only 2 weeks after we come back from break, you know. There are going to be some good schools there, and your times lately have not been great."
"Yes, Coach."
"I really want to include you on the team, Daniel, but I need to see a marked improvement when you come back."
"Okay, Coach."
"You're going home for midterm?"
"Yes."
"There's a pool up there. Where are you again, Rush?"
"Yeah, there's a pool, and also I swim in the sea, too."
"I see. That's good. Well, try and get as much practice as you can over the holiday. All right?"
"Yes, Coach."
"Good."
Coach's mouth tightens. The skin of his face is wrinkly, but his eyes are clear blue, like a swimming pool waiting for someone to dive in.
"Daniel, is everything all right with you? Lately I've been getting the impression that there's something on your mind."
"No, Coach, not at all."
"You're sure? This illness of yours, you're over that?"
"Oh, yeah, totally."
"Okay."
The eyes monitor his, unblinkingly.
"I just want you to know that if there is something bothering you, you can come to me and talk about it. That's what I'm here for. Everything private and confidential."
"Thanks, Coach."
"I'm not some old teacher. I'm your coach. I take care of my boys."
"I know that, Coach. Everything's fine, though."
"That's good. You're looking forward to seeing your parents, I bet."
"Sure."
"How are they doing?"
"Fine."
"Your mum?"
"She's fine." Coach's hand on his shoulder.
"You give them my very best, okay? They should be very proud of you. You say that to them from me."
He stands up. "Okay, I will."
"And remember, train hard. I want you on that bus to Galway."
"Okay." But Coach has turned away and is blowing his whistle at Siddharthan Island, who is jumping around waving a pair of swimming togs. In the shallow end, Dwayne Grehan is crying out,
"My shorts! My shorts!"
Steam rolls around the water in swaggering piles, but to your skin it is freezing cold. Very last class before midterm. Until recently, the Irish teacher, Miss Nireen, in spite of her advanced years, strangely conical breasts and appearance, thanks to whatever brand of foundation she uses, of being made out of toffee, was widely considered Seabrook's number one babe, and the object of more than a few fixations, which no doubt says something about the nature of desire and its surprising willingness to work with the materials at hand. Since the arrival of Miss McIntyre, however, that particular illusion has been shattered, and Irish is now just another dull class to be struggled through. There are ways of easing that struggle, though. In the middle of a boring sequence of interchanges on the Mull Quinilock, Gaelic's infamously difficult conditional mood, Casey Ellington raises his hand.
"Miss?"
"Yes, Casey?"
"Someone told me that Halloween actually started in Ireland,"
Casey says with a furrowed brow.
"That can't be true, can it?"
The name of the boy who first discovered Miss Nireen's undergraduate degree in Irish folklore is lost to time, but the proud work he began lives on to this day. Angle it in the right way, and a single well-placed question can sometimes burn up an entire class. Halloween, Casey Ellington learns, is a direct descendant of the Celtic rite of Samhain. In days of yore, Samhain, also known as Féile Mumhinne, or the Feast of the White Goddess, was one of the most important festivals. Held at the end of October, it marked the end of one pastoral year and the beginning of the next. An enchanted time, when the gates between this world and the other world were opened, and ancient forces were let loose on the land.
Other world?
Mitchell Gogan raising his hand this time.
Irish folklore is dominated by tales of a mysterious supernatural race called the She.
Miss Ní Rian says.
The She inhabited another world, which shared the same space as ours, but could not be seen by humans. She is usually translated as fairies.
Annie giggling here is vigorously stifled in the interests of keeping the digression in the air.
But these fairies didn't have pretty wings or little pink frocks or hang around flower petals. They were taller than humans and famous for their cruelty. They'd turn men blind, steal newborn babies, cast spells on whole herds of cattle so that they wouldn't eat and pined away, just for fun. It was considered bad luck even to speak their name. On the night of Samhain, all fires were extinguished and the entrances to the burial mounds where they were believed to live left open, until cockcrow next morning.
They lived in burial mounds,
says Neville Nelligan, no longer sure whether he's time-wasting or actually interested.
They lived in earthworks, beside rivers, beneath particular trees, in underwater caves. They also lived in burial mounds that dotted the countryside. Originally, the word She referred to these mounds, which were built by an older civilization thousands of years before. Later on, people came to think of them as palaces that belonged to the fairies and connected their world to ours. There were folk tales about men who fell asleep near one of these mounds and woke up with the gift of poetry or storytelling, or who discovered a door in the hillside and found their way into a feast underground, always with lovely harp music, sumptuous food, beautiful maidens, only to wake up next morning on the hillside, with no sign of the doorway, and go into the village to find that hundreds of years had passed and everyone they knew was dead.
Perhaps it's the somber weather, the gaunt wind, and skeletal rattling of the fallen leaves outside. Or maybe it's heightened sensibilities from the incipient hop. But these stories take on a weird palpability. You can feel them, a shivery, mournful fog that weaves its way through the air.
So if they lived in burial mounds...
Jeff, barely daring to believe it.
Does that mean the fairies were... undead?
Gods, fairies, ghosts, they were all mixed together as inhabitants of the other world,
the teacher says.
Initially, the fairy legends may have started off as stories of the dead living on, feasting in their chambers, or as a way of explaining what happened to this previous pre-Celtic civilization that had now disappeared. But the point is that at Samhain, all of these strange beings, who lived side by side with us, but who for the most part we didn't see, became visible and went roaming the land.
And where did they go then?
Vince Bailey asks.
Where did who go?
The gods or the fairies or whoever they were.
Well, I don't know.
Miss Ní Rian hasn't considered this.
Maybe they were hit by a meteor.
Niall Heenahan interjects eagerly.
Like the dinosaurs?
Maybe they're still there.
A zombified voice suggests.
Jeff, I've told you 100 times about that voice.
Sorry.
Anyway, none of this is getting us any closer to understanding the Mó Cuailnge. Where were we?
Miss Ní Rian settles her attention on the textbook, but at that moment the bell goes. School's out. The boys leap out of their seats. She smiles ruefully, realizing she's been had.
All right. Have a good holiday, boys. Enjoy the dance tonight.
Happy Halloween, miss.
Happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween.
Oh, Jeff, for the last time.
She trails off. Jeff has already left the room. By 4 o'clock, except for the small gaggle that scurries back and forth between the art room and the sports hall, arms heaped with dyed black netting, papier-mâché skulls, partially eviscerated pumpkins with craft knives still jutting from their flanks, the school is utterly deserted. Or so it appears. Beneath the superficial emptiness, the air groans with the freight of anticipation. The silence shrieks. The space trembles. Crammed with previsions so feverish and intense that they begin to threaten to flicker into being, there in the depopulated hallways. Meanwhile, above the old stone campus, somber grey clouds gather, laden and growling with pent-up energies of their own. Upstairs, although the sun has not yet quite set, and although, of course, for the rest of the world it does not officially fall for another 5 days, Halloween is in full swing. The gothic environs of the junior rec room abound with bedsheet ghosts, plastic-fanged vampires, rubicund Osama bin Ladens, and robed Jedi. Frankenstein's monster applies contusions to Victor Hero, deceased. Two incompletely wrapped mummies quarrel over the last roll of toilet paper. The Scarlet Pimpernel hatches a plan with the Green Goblin to buy drink with a goblin's big brother's fake ID. Here and there, older boarders from the higher years, still waiting around for lifts home, look on scornfully and make sarcastic remarks. But the boys barely hear, being too caught up in the moment, and in their costumes, where they feel curiously at home, seeming to inhabit them in a way quite different to the awkward relationships they have with their school uniforms.